this morning. I sent her to the shop to get some cucumbers, and it was 3 hours before she was back. I had a feeling in my heart when I sent her. It ached, it did. Didn't it ache? Where's she been? Where did she go? What protectors has she found for herself? As though I'd not been a good friend to her. Why, I forgave your slut of a mother a debt of 14 rubles, buried her at my own expense, and took the little devil to bring up. You know that, my dear soul. You know it yourself. Why have I no rights over her after that? She should feel it, but instead of feeling it, she goes against me. I wished for her good. I wanted to put her in a muslin frock, the dirty slut. I bought her boots at the Gostivny Dvor, and decked her out like a peacock, a sight for a holiday. And would you believe it, good friends, 2 days later she'd torn up the dress, torn it into rags, and that's how she goes about, that's how she goes about. And what do you think? She tore it on purpose. I wouldn't tell a lie, I saw it myself. As much as to say she would go in rags, she wouldn't wear muslin. Well, I paid her out. I did give her a drubbing. Then I called in the doctor afterwards and had to pay him too. If I throttled you, you vermin, I should be quit with not touching milk for a week. That would be penance enough for strangling you. I made her scrub the floor for a punishment. And what do you think? She scrubbed and scrubbed. The jade. It vexed me to see her scrubbing. Well, why, she'll run away from me now. And I'd scarcely thought it when I looked round and off she'd gone yesterday. You heard how I beat her for it yesterday, good friends. I made my arms ache. I took away her shoes and stockings. She won't go off barefoot, thought I. Yet she gave me the slip today, too. Where have you been? Speak! Who have you been complaining of me to, you nettleseed? Who have you been telling tales to? Speak, you gypsy, you foreign mask, speak!
And in her frenzy she rushed at the little girl, who stood, petrified with horror, clutched her by the hair and flung her on the ground. The cup with the cucumbers in it was dashed aside and broken. This only increased the drunken fury's rage. She beat her victim about the face and the head, but Elena remained obstinately mute. Not a sound, not a cry, not a complaint escaped her, even under the blows. I rushed into the yard, almost beside myself with indignation, and went straight to the drunken woman. "What are you about? How dare you treat a poor orphan like that?" I cried, seizing the fury by her arm.
"What's this? Who are you?"
she screamed, leaving Elena and putting her arms akimbo.
"What do you want in my house?"
"To tell you you're a heartless woman," I cried. "How dare you bully a poor child like that? She's not yours. I've just heard that she's only adopted. A poor orphan."
"Lord Jesus!"
cried the fury.
"But who are you poking your nose in? Did you come with her, eh? I'll go straight to the police captain. Andrei Timofeyitch himself treats me like a lady. Why, is it to see you she goes, eh? Who is it? He's come to make an upset in another person's house. Police!"
And she flew at me, brandishing her fists. But at that instant we heard a piercing, inhuman shriek. I looked. Elena, who had been standing as though unconscious, uttering a strange, unnatural scream, fell with a thud on the ground, writhing in awful convulsions. Her face was working. She was in an epileptic fit. The dishevelled female and the woman from the basement ran, lifted her up, and hurriedly carried her up the steps.
"She may choke for me, the damned slut!"
the woman shrieked after her.
"That's the third fit this month! Get off, you pickpocket!"
And she rushed at me again.
"Why are you standing there, porter? What do you get your wages for?"
"Get along, get along. You want a smack on the head?" the porter boomed out lazily, apparently only as a matter of form. "Two's company and three's none. Make your bow and take your hook."
There was no help for it. I went out at the gate, feeling that my interference had been useless. But I was boiling with indignation. I stood on the pavement, facing the gateway, and looked through the gate. As soon as I had gone out, the woman rushed up the steps, and the porter, having done his duty, vanished. Soon after, the woman who had helped to carry up Elena hurried down the steps on the way to the basement. Seeing me, she stood still and looked at me with curiosity. Her quiet, good-natured face encouraged me. I went back into the yard and straight up to her. "Allow me to ask," I said, "who is that girl, and what is that horrible woman doing with her? Please don't imagine that I ask simply from curiosity. I've met the girl, and owing to special circumstances, I am much interested in her."
"If you're interested in her, you'd better take her home, or find some place for her than let her come to ruin here,"
said the woman with apparent reluctance, making a movement to get away from me. "But if you don't tell me, what can I do? I tell you, I know nothing about her. I suppose that's Madame Bubnov herself, the woman of the house."
"Yes."
"Then how did the girl fall into her hands? Did her mother die here?"
"Oh, I can't say. It's not our business."
And again she would have moved away. "But please, do me a kindness. I tell you, it's very interesting to me. Perhaps I may be able to do something. Who is the girl? What was her mother? Do you know?
She looked like a foreigner of some sort. She lived down below with us, but she was ill. She died of consumption.
Then she must have been very poor if she shared a room in the basement.
Oh, she was poor. My heart was always aching for her. We simply lived from hand to mouth, yet she owed us 6 rubles in the 5 months she lived with us. We buried her, too. My husband made the coffin.
How was it, then, that woman said she'd buried her?
As though she'd buried her.
And what was her surname?
I can't pronounce it, sir. It's difficult. It must have been German.
Smith?
No, not quite that. Well, Anna Trifonovna took charge of the orphan to bring her up, she says. But it's not the right thing at all.
I suppose she took her for some object.
She's a woman who's up to no good,
answered the woman, seeming to ponder and hesitate whether to speak or not.
What is it to us? We're outsiders.
You'd better keep a check on your tongue, I heard a man's voice say behind us.
It was a middle-aged man in a dressing gown, with a full coat over the dressing gown, who looked like an artisan, the woman's husband.
She's no call to be talking to you, sir. It's not our business, he said, looking askance at me. And you go in. Goodbye, sir. We're coffin makers. If you ever need anything in our way, we shall be pleased. But apart from that, we've nothing to say.
I went out, musing and greatly excited. I could do nothing, but I felt that it was hard for me to leave it like this. Some words dropped by the coffin-maker's wife revolted me particularly. There was something wrong here. I felt that. I was walking away, looking down and meditating, when suddenly a sharp voice called me by my surname. I looked up. Before me stood a man who had been drinking and was almost staggering, dressed fairly neatly, though he had a shabby overcoat and a greasy cap. His face was very familiar. I looked more closely at it. He winked at me and smiled ironically.
Don't you know me?
Chapter 5. Ah, why, it's you, Maslobuev, I cried, suddenly recognizing him as an old schoolfellow who had been at my provincial gymnasium. Well, this is a meeting.
Yes, a meeting indeed. We've not met for 6 years. Or rather, we have met, but your excellency hasn't deigned to look at me. To be sure, you're a general. A literary one, that is, eh?
He smiled ironically as he said it. Come, Maslobuev, old boy, you're talking nonsense, I interrupted. Generals look very different from me, even if they are literary ones. And besides, let me tell you, I certainly do remember having met you twice in the street. But you obviously avoided me. And why should I go up to a man if I see he's trying to avoid me? And do you know what I believe? If you weren't drunk, you wouldn't have called to me even now. That's true, isn't it? Well, how are you? I'm very, very glad to have met you, my boy.
Really, and I'm not compromising you by my unconventional appearance. But there's no need to ask that. It's not a great matter. I always remember what a jolly chap you were, old Vanya. You remember you took a thrashing for me. You held your tongue and didn't give me away, and instead of being grateful, I jeered at you for a week afterwards. You're a blessed innocent. Glad to see you, my dear soul.
We kissed each other.
How many years I've been pining in solitude. From morn till night, from dark till light. But I've not forgotten old times. They're not easy to forget. But what have you been doing? What have you been doing?
I? Why, I'm pining in solitude, too. He gave me a long look, full of the deep feeling of a man slightly inebriated, though he was a very good-natured fellow at any time.
No, Vanya, your case is not like mine.
He brought out at last in a tragic tone.
I've read it, Vanya, you know. I've read it. But I say, let us have a good talk. Are you in a hurry?
I am in a hurry, and I must confess I'm very much upset about something. I'll tell you what's better. Where do you live?
I'll tell you. But that's not better. Shall I tell you what is better?
Why, what?
Why, this, do you see?
And he pointed out to me a sign a few yards from where we were standing.
You see, confectioners and restaurant. That is simply an eating house, but it's a good place. I tell you, it's a decent place, and the vodka, there's no word for it. I've come all the way from Kiev on foot. I've tasted it. Many a time I've tasted it. I know. And they wouldn't dare offer me poor stuff here. They know Philip Filippich. I'm Philip Filippich, you know, eh? You make a face. No, let me have my say. Now it's 11:15. I've just looked. Well, at 11:55 exactly, I'll let you go. And in the meantime, we'll drain the flowing bowl. 20 minutes for an old friend. Is that right?
If it will really be 20 minutes, all right. Because, my dear chap, I really am busy.
Well, that's a bargain. But I tell you what, two words to begin with. You don't look cheerful, as though you were put out about something. Is that so?
Yes.
I guessed it. I'm going in for the study of physiognomy, you know. It's an occupation, too. So, come along. We'll have a talk. In 20 minutes I shall have time, in the first place, to sip the cup that cheers and to toss off a glass of Bert's wine and another of orange bitters, then a parfait amour and anything else I can think of. I drink, old man. I'm good for nothing except on a holiday before service. But don't you drink. I want you just as you are. Though if you did drink, you'd betray a peculiar nobility of soul. Come along. We'll have a little chat and then part for another 10 years. I'm not fit company for you, friend Vanya.
Don't chatter so much, but come along. You shall have 20 minutes and then let me go. To get to the eating house, we had to go to a wooden staircase of 2 flights leading from the street to the 2nd story. But on the stairs, we suddenly came upon 2 gentlemen, very drunk. Seeing us, they moved aside, staggering. One of them was a very young and youthful-looking lad, with an exaggeratedly stupid expression of face, with only a faint trace of moustache and no beard. He was dressed like a dandy, but looked ridiculous, as though he were dressed up in someone else's clothes. He had expensive-looking rings on his fingers, an expensive pin in his tie, and his hair was combed up into a crest which looked particularly absurd. He kept smiling and sniggering. His companion, a thick-set, corpulent, bald-headed man of 50, with a puffy, drunken, pockmarked face and a nose like a button, was dressed rather carelessly, though he, too, had a big pin in his tie and wore spectacles. The expression of his face was malicious and sensual. His nasty, spiteful, and suspicious-looking little eyes were lost in fat and seemed to be peeping through chinks. Evidently they both knew Maslobuev, but the fat man made a momentary grimace of vexation on seeing us, while the young man subsided into a grin of obsequious sweetness. He even took off his cap. He was wearing a cap.
"Excuse us, Philip Filippich,"
he muttered, gazing tenderly at him.
"What's up?"
"I beg your pardon, I'm..."
He flicked at his collar.
"Mitroshka's in there. So it seems he's a scoundrel, Philip Filippich."
"Well, what's the matter?"
"Why, it seems so... Why, last week he..."
Here he nodded towards his companion.
"Got his mug smeared with sour cream in a shocking place, all through that chap Mitroshka. He..."
His companion looked annoyed, poked him with his elbow.
"You should come with us, Philip Filippich. We'd empty a half dozen. May we hope for your company?"
"No, my dear man, I can't now," answered Maslobuev. "I've business."
"He, and I've a little business, too, concerning you."
Again, his companion nudged him with his elbow.
"Afterwards, afterwards."
Maslobuev was unmistakably trying not to look at them. But no sooner had we entered the outer room, along the whole length of which ran a fairly clean counter covered with eatables, pies, tarts, and decanters of different coloured liqueurs, when Maslobuev drew me into a corner and said,
"The young fellow Sizobyuhov, the son of the celebrated corn dealer. He came in for 500,000 when his father died, and now he's having a good time. He went to Paris, and there he got through no end of money. He'd have spent all there, perhaps, but he came in for another fortune when his uncle died, and he came back from Paris. So he's getting through the rest of it here. In another year he'll be sending the hat round. He's as stupid as a goose. He goes about in the best restaurants, and in cellars and taverns, and with actresses, and he's trying to get into the hussars. He's just applied for a commission. The other, the old fellow, Ahipov, is something in the way of a merchant, too, or an agent. He had something to do with government contracts, too. He's a beast, a rogue, and now he's a pal of Sizobyov's. He's a Judas and a Falstaff both at once. He's twice been made bankrupt, and he's a disgusting, sensual brute, up to all sorts of tricks. I know one criminal affair in that line that he was mixed up in, but he managed to get off. For one thing, I'm very glad I met him here. I was on the lookout for him. He's plucking Sizobyuhov now, of course. He knows all sorts of queer places, which is what makes him of use to young fellows like that. I've had a grudge against him for ever so long. Mitroshka's got a bone to pick with him, too. That dashing-looking fellow with a gypsy face in the smart tunic, standing by the window. He deals in horses. He's known to all the hussars about here. I tell you, he's such a clever rogue that he'll make a false banknote before your very eyes and pass it off upon you, though you've seen it. He wears a tunic, though it's a velvet one, and looks like a slavophile, though I think it suits him. But put him into a fine dress coat or something like it, and take him to the English club and call him the great landowner, Count Barabanov. He'll pass for a count for 2 hours, play whist, and talk like a count, and they'll never guess. He'll take them in. He'll come to a bad end. Well, Mitroska's got a great grudge against the fat man, for Mitroska's hard up just now. Przizobuhov used to be very thick with him, but the fat man's carried him off before Mitroska had time to fleece him. If they met in the eating-house just now, there must be something up. I know something about it, too, and can guess what it is, for Mitroska and no one else told me that they'd be here, and be hanging about these parts after some mischief. I want to take advantage of Mitroska's hatred for Arhipov, for I have my own reasons, and indeed I came here chiefly on that account. I don't want to let Mitroska see, and don't you keep looking at him, but when we go out he's sure to come up of himself and tell me what I want to know. Now, come along, Vanya, into the other room, do you see? Now, Stepan,
he said, addressing the waiter,
you understand what I want?
Yes, sir.
And you'll bring it?
Yes, sir.
Mind you do. Sit down, Vanya.
Why do you keep looking at me like that?
I see you're looking at me. Are you surprised? Don't be surprised. Anything may happen to a man, even what he's never dreamed of. Especially in the days when... Well, in the days when we used to cram Cornelius Nepos together. And, Vanya, be sure of one thing. Though Maslobov may have strayed from the true path, his heart is still unchanged. It's only circumstances that have altered. Though I may be in the soot, I'm no dirtier than the rest. I set up for being a doctor, and I trained as a teacher of Russian literature, and I wrote an article on Gogol, and thought of going to the gold diggings, and meant to get married. A living soul longs for the sweet in life, and she consented, though I was so poor I had nothing to tempt a cat with. I was on the point of borrowing a pair of good boots for the marriage ceremony, for mine had been in holes for 18 months. But I didn't get married. She married a teacher, and I went as a counting-house clerk. Not a commercial counting-house, but just a counting-house. But then the tune changed. Years have rolled by, and though I'm not in the service, I make enough to jog along. I take bribes without ruth, and yet stand firm for the truth. I hunt with the hounds, and I run with the hare. I have principles. I know, for instance, that one can't fight single-handed, and I mind my own business. My business is chiefly in the confidential line, you understand.
You're not some sort of detective, are you?
No, not exactly a detective, but I do take up jobs, partly professionally and partly on my own account. It's this way, Vanya. I drink vodka, but as I haven't drunk my wits away, I know what lies before me. My time is past. There's no washing a black nag white. One thing I will say. If the man in me were not echoing still, I should not have come up to you today, Vanya. You're right, I'd met you and seen you before, and many a time I longed to speak, but still I didn't dare and put it off. I'm not worthy of you. And you were right, Vanya, when you said that I spoke this time only because I was drunk, and though this is all awful rot, we'll finish with me now. We'd better talk of you. Well, my dear soul, I've read it through. I'm talking of your firstborn. When I read it, I almost became a respectable man, my friend. I was almost becoming one, but I thought better of it, and preferred to remain a disreputable man. So, there it is.
And he said much more. He got more and more drunk, and became very maudlin, almost lachrymose. Maslobuev had always been a capital fellow, but cunning, and, as it were, precocious. He had been a shrewd, crafty, artful dodger from his high school days upwards, but he really had a good heart. He was a lost man. Among Russians there are many such. They often have great abilities, but everything seems topsy-turvy in them, and what's more, they are quite capable of acting against their conscience in certain cases through weakness, and not only come to ruin, but know beforehand that they are on the road to ruin. Maslobuev, for instance, was drowning in vodka.
One more word now, friend,
he went on.
I heard what a noise your fame made at first. I read several criticisms on you afterwards. I really did. You imagine I never read anything. I met you afterwards in shabby boots, in the mud, without galoshes, with a battered hat, and I drew my own conclusions. You're going in for being a journalist now, eh?
Yes, Maslobuev.
Join the literary hacks, I suppose.
That's about it.
Well, I tell you what then, my boy. Drinking's better. Here, I drink. I lie on the sofa, and I have a capital sofa with springs, and I imagine myself Homer or Dante or some Frederick Barbosa. One can fancy what one likes, you know. But you can't fancy yourself a Dante or a Frederick Barbosa. In the first place, because you want to be yourself, and secondly, because all wishing is forbidden you, for you're a literary hack. I have a fancy, but you have reality. Listen, tell me openly, straightforwardly, speaking as a brother. If you won't, you'll offend and humiliate me for 10 years. Don't you want money? I've plenty. Oh, don't make faces. Take some of it. Pay off the entrepreneurs. Throw off the yoke. Then, when you're secure for a year's living, settle down to a cherished idea. Write a great book, eh? What do you say?
Listen, Maslobuev, I appreciate your brotherly offer, but I can't make any answer at present, and the reason why is a long story. There are circumstances. But I promise that I'll tell you everything afterwards, like a brother. I thank you for your offer. I promise that I'll come to you, and I'll come often. But this is what I want to tell you. You have been open with me, and so I've made up my mind to ask your advice, especially as I believe you're first-rate in such affairs. I told him the whole story of Smith and his granddaughter, beginning with the scene in the restaurant. Strange to say, as I told my tale, it seemed to me from his eyes that he knew something about the story. I asked him.
"No, not exactly," he answered, "though I had heard something about Smith, a story of some old man dying in a restaurant. But I really do know something about Madame Bubnov. Only 2 months ago I got some money out of that lady. Je prends mon bière où je la trouve, and that's the only respect in which I am like Molière. Though I squeezed 100 roubles out of her, I vowed at the time I'd wring another 500 out of her before I'd done. She's a nasty woman. She's in an unmentionable line of business. That wouldn't matter, but sometimes it goes too far. Don't imagine I'm a Don Quixote, please. The point is that I may make a very good thing of it, and when I met Szobryov half an hour ago, I was awfully pleased. Szobryov was evidently brought here, and the fat man brought him, and as I know what the fat man's special trade is, I conclude... Well, I'll show him up. I'm very glad I heard from you about that girl. It's another clue for me. I undertake all sorts of private jobs, you know, and I know some queer people. I investigated a little affair for a prince not long ago. An affair, I tell you, one wouldn't have expected from that prince. Or would you care to hear another story about a married woman? You come and see me, old man, and I shall have subjects ready for you that people will never believe in if you write about them.
And what was the name of that prince? I asked, with a foreboding of something.
What do you want to know for? All right, it's Valkovsky.
Piotr.
Yes, do you know him?
Yes, but not very well. Well, Maslobuev, I shall come to you to inquire about that gentleman more than once again, I said, getting up. You've interested me greatly.
Well, old boy, you can come as often as you like. I can tell you fine tales, though only within certain limits, do you understand? Or else one loses one's credit and honour in business, that is, and all the rest of it.
All right, as far as honour permits. I was really agitated. He noticed it. Well, what do you say about the story I told you? Have you thought of something?
Your story? Well, wait a couple of minutes. I will pay.
He went up to the buffet, and there, as though by chance, stood close by the young man in the tunic who was so unceremoniously called Mitroshka. It seemed to me that Maslobuev knew him a good deal better than he had admitted to me. Anyway, it was evident that they were not meeting for the first time. Mitroshka was a rather original-looking fellow. In his sleeveless tunic and red silk shirt, with his sharp but handsome features, with his young-looking, swarthy face and his bold, sparkling eyes, he made a curious and not unattractive impression. There was an assumption of jauntiness in his gestures, and yet, at the moment, he was evidently restraining himself, aiming rather at an air of business-like gravity and sedateness.
"Look here, Vanya," said Maslobuev when he rejoined me. "Look me up this evening at 7 o'clock, and I may have something to tell you. By myself, you see, I'm no use. In old days I was, but now I'm only a drunkard and have got out of the way of things. But I've still kept my old connections. I may find out something. I sniff about among all sorts of sharp people. That's how I get on. In my free time, that is, when I'm sober, I do something myself, it's true, through friends, too, mostly in the investigation line. But that's neither here nor there. Enough. Here's my address, in Shestilovochny Street. But now, my boy, I'm really too far gone. I'll swallow another and home. I'll lie down a bit. If you come, I'll introduce you to Alexandra Semyonovna, and if there's time, we'll discuss poetry.
Well, and that, too?
All right, that, too, perhaps.
Perhaps I will come. I'll certainly come. Chapter 6. Anna Andreevna had long been expecting me. What I had told her the day before about Natasha's note had greatly excited her curiosity, and she had expected me much earlier in the morning, by 10 o'clock at the latest. By the time I turned up at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, the poor woman's agonies of suspense had reached an extreme pitch. She was longing, too, to talk to me of the new hopes aroused in her the day before, and of Nikolai Sergeyitch, who had been ailing since then, who was gloomy and at the same time seemed specially tender to her. When I made my appearance, she received me with an expression of coldness and displeasure in her face, hardly opened her mouth, and showed no sign of interest, almost as though she would ask why I had come, and what possessed me to drop in every day. She was angry at my coming so late. But I was in a hurry, and without further delay I described to her the whole scene at Natasha's the evening before. As soon as she heard of the elder prince's visit and his solemn proposal, her assumed indifference vanished instantly. I cannot find words to describe how delighted she was. She seemed quite beside herself, crossed herself, shed tears, bowed down before the icons, embraced me, and was on the point of running to Nikolai Sergeyitch to tell him of her joy.
"Bless me, my dear! Why, it's all the insults and humiliation he's been through that are making him ill, and as soon as he knows that full reparation will be made to Natasha, he'll forget it all in a twinkling."
I had much ado to dissuade her. Though the good lady had lived 25 years with her husband, she did not understand him. She was desperately anxious, too, to set off with me immediately to Natasha's. I put it to her not only that Nikolai Sergeyitch would disapprove of her action, but that we might even ruin the whole business by going. With difficulty she was brought to think better of it, but she detained me another half hour unnecessarily, talking herself the whole time.
"With whom shall I be left here?"
she said,
"sitting alone within four walls with such joy in my heart."
At last I persuaded her to let me go, reminding her that Natasha must be sick of waiting for me. She made the sign of the cross several times to bless me on my way, sent a special blessing to Natasha, and almost shed tears when I absolutely refused to come back again that evening, unless anything special had happened at Natasha's. I did not see Nikolai Sergeyitch on this occasion. He had been awake all night, complained of a headache, a chill, and was now asleep in his study. Natasha, too, had been expecting me all the morning. When I went in, she was, as usual, walking up and down the room with her hands clasped, meditating. Even now, when I think of her, I always see her alone in a poor room, dreamy, deserted, waiting with folded hands and downcast eyes, walking aimlessly up and down. Still walking up and down, she asked me in a low voice why I was so late. I gave her a brief account of all my adventures, but she scarcely listened. One could see she was in great anxiety about something. "Anything fresh?" I asked her.
"Nothing fresh,"
she answered. But I guessed at once from her face that there was something fresh, and that she was expecting me on purpose to tell me. And she would tell me, not at once, but just as I was going, as she always did. That was always our habit. I was used to her and waited. We began, of course, talking of the previous evening. I was particularly struck by the fact that we were quite agreed in our impression of Prince Valkovsky, and she positively disliked him much more than she had at the time. And when we analyzed the visit point by point, Natasha suddenly said,
"Listen, Vanya, you know it's always like that. If one doesn't like a man at first, it's almost a sure sign that one will like him afterwards. That's how it's always been with me, anyway."
"Let us hope so, Natasha. And this is my opinion, and it's a final one. I went over it all, and what I deduced was that though the prince was perhaps Jesuitical, he is giving his consent to your marriage genuinely and in earnest." Natasha stood still in the middle of the room and looked at me sternly. Her whole face was transformed. Her lips twitched a little.
"But how could he, in a case like this, begin deceiving and lying?"
"Of course not, of course not," I assented hurriedly.
"Of course he wasn't lying. It seems to me there's no need to think of that. There's no excuse to be found for such deception. And indeed, am I so abject in his eyes that he could jeer at me like that? Could any man be capable of such an insult?
Of course not, of course not. I agreed, thinking to myself, you're thinking of nothing else as you pace up and down, my poor girl, and very likely you're more doubtful about it than I am.
And how I could wish you were coming back sooner,
she said.
He wanted to spend the whole evening with me, and then, it must have been important business, since he's given it all up and gone away. You don't know what it was, Vanya. You haven't heard anything.
The Lord only knows. You know he's always making money. I've heard he's taking up a share in some contract in Petersburg. We know nothing about business, Natasha.
Of course we don't. Alyosha talked of some letter yesterday.
News of some sort. Has Alyosha been here?
Yes.
Early?
At 12 o'clock. He sleeps late, you know. He stayed a little while. I sent him off to Katerina Fyodorovna. Shouldn't I have Vanya?
Why, didn't he mean to go himself?
Yes, he did.
She was about to say more, but checked herself. I looked at her and waited. Her face was sad. I would have questioned her, but she sometimes particularly disliked questions.
He's a strange boy,
she said at last, with a slight twist of her mouth, trying not to look at me. Why? I suppose something's happened.
No, nothing. I just thought so. He was sweet, though. But already...
All his cares and anxieties are over now, said I. Natasha looked intently and searchingly at me. She felt inclined, perhaps, to answer, he hadn't many cares or anxieties before, but she fancied that my words covered the same thought. She pouted. But she became friendly and cordial again at once. This time she was extraordinarily gentle. I spent more than an hour with her. She was very uneasy. The prince had frightened her. I noticed from some of her questions that she was very anxious to know what sort of impression she had made on him. Had she behaved properly? Hadn't she betrayed her joy too openly? Had she been too ready to take offense? Or, on the contrary, too conciliatory? He mustn't imagine anything. He mustn't laugh at her. He mustn't feel contempt for her. Her cheeks glowed like fire at the thought. How can you be so upset simply at a bad man's imagining something? Let him imagine anything, said I.
Why is he bad?
She asked. Natasha was suspicious but pure-hearted and straightforward. Her doubts came from no impure source. She was proud and with a fine pride, and would not endure what she looked upon as higher than anything to be turned into a laughing-stock before her. She would, of course, have met with contempt the contempt of a base man, but at the same time her heart would have ached at mockery of what she thought sacred, whoever had been the mocker. This was not due to any lack of firmness. It arose partly from too limited a knowledge of the world, from being unaccustomed to people, from having been shut up in her own little groove. She had spent all her life in her own little corner and had hardly left it. And finally, that characteristic of good-natured people, inherited perhaps from her father, the habit of thinking highly of people, of persistently thinking them better than they really are, warmly exaggerating everything good in them, was highly developed in her. It is hard for such people to be disillusioned afterwards, and it is hardest of all when one feels one is oneself to blame. Why did one expect more than could be given? And such a disappointment is always in store for such people. It is best for them to stay quietly in their corners and not to go out into the world. I have noticed, in fact, that they really love their corners so much that they grow shy and unsociable in them. Natasha, however, had suffered many misfortunes, many mortifications. She was already a wounded creature, and she cannot be blamed, if indeed there be any blame in what I have said. But I was in a hurry and got up to go. She was surprised and almost cried at my going, though she had shown no particular affection for me all the while I was with her. On the contrary, she seemed rather colder to me than usual. She kissed me warmly and looked for a long time into my face.
Listen,
she said.
Alyosha was very absurd this morning and quite surprised me. He was very sweet, very happy apparently, but flew in, such a butterfly, such a dandy, and kept prinking before the looking-glass. He's a little too unceremonious now. Yes, and he didn't stay long. Fancy, he brought me some sweets.
Sweets? Why, that's very charming and simple-hearted. Ah, what a pair you are! Now you've begun watching and spying on one another, studying each other's faces and reading hidden thoughts in them, and understanding nothing about it. He's not different. He's merry and schoolboyish, as he always was. But you... And whenever Natasha changed her tone and came to me with some complaint against Alyosha, or to ask for a solution of some ticklish question, or to tell me some secret, expecting me to understand her at half a word, she always, I remember, looked at me with a smile, as it were imploring me to answer somehow so that she should feel happy at heart at once. And I remember, too, I always, in such cases, assumed a severe and harsh tone as though scolding someone, and this happened quite unconsciously with me, but it was always successful. My severity and gravity were what was wanted. They seemed more authoritative, and people sometimes feel an irresistible craving to be scolded. Natasha was sometimes left quite consoled.
"No, Vanya, you see,"
she went on, keeping one of her little hands on my shoulder, while her other pressed my hand and her eyes looked into mine.
"I fancied that he was somehow too little affected. He seemed already such a man, you know, as though he'd been married 10 years, but was still polite to his wife. Isn't that very premature? He laughed and prinked, but just as though all that didn't matter, as though it only partly concerned me, not as it used to be. He was in a great hurry to see Katerina Fyodorovna. If I spoke to him, he didn't listen to me, or began talking of something else. You know, that horrid aristocratic habit we've both been getting him out of. In fact, he was too... even indifferent, it seemed. But what am I saying? Here, I'm doing it. Here, I've begun. Ah, what exacting, capricious despots we all are, Vanya. Only now I see it. We can't forgive a man for a trifling change in his face, and God knows what has made his face change. You were right, Vanya, in reproaching me just now. It's all my fault. We make our own troubles, and then we complain of them. Thanks, Vanya. You have quite comforted me. Ah, if he would only come today. But there, perhaps he'll be angry for what happened this morning."
"Surely you haven't quarrelled already?" I cried with surprise.
"I made no sign, but I was a little sad, and though he came in so cheerful, he suddenly became thoughtful, and I fancied he said goodbye coldly. Yes, I'll send for him. You come too, today, Vanya."
"Yes, I'll be sure to, unless I'm detained by one thing."
"Why, what thing is it?"
"I've brought it on myself, but I think I'm sure to come all the same." Chapter 7. At 7 o'clock precisely I was at Maslobuev's. He lived in Lodge, a little house in Shestolovochny Street. He had 3 rather grubby but not badly furnished rooms. There was even the appearance of some prosperity, at the same time an extreme slovenliness. The door was opened by a very pretty girl of 19, plainly but charmingly dressed, clean, and with very good-natured, merry eyes. I at once guessed that this was the Alexandra Semyonovna to whom he had made passing allusion that morning, holding out an introduction to her as an allurement to me. She asked who I was, and hearing my name said that Maslobuev was expecting me, but that he was asleep now in his room, to which she took me. Maslobuev was asleep on a very good soft sofa with his dirty greatcoat over him, and a shabby leather pillow under his head. He was sleeping very lightly. As soon as we went in, he called me by name.
"Ah, that was you. I was expecting you. I was just dreaming you'd come in and wake me. So it's time. Come along."
"Where are we going?"
"To see a lady."
"What lady? Why?"
"Madame Bubnov, to pay her out. Isn't she a beauty?"
he drawled, turning to Alexandra Semyonovna, and he positively kissed his fingertips at the thought of Madame Bubnov.
"Get along, you're making it up,"
said Alexandra Semyonovna, feeling it incumbent on her to make a show of anger.
"Don't you know her? Let me introduce you, old man. Here, Alexandra Semyonovna, let me present to you a literary general. It's only once a year he's on view for nothing. At other times you have to pay."
"Here he is, up to his nonsense again. Don't you listen to him. He's always laughing at me. How can this gentleman be a general?"
"That's just what I tell you. He's a special sort. But don't you imagine, Your Excellency, that we're silly. We are much cleverer than we seem at first sight."
"Don't listen to him. He's always putting me to confusion before honest folk, the shameless fellow. He'd much better take me to the theatre sometimes."
"Alexandra Semyonovna, love your household. Haven't you forgotten that you must love? Haven't you forgotten the word, the one I taught you?"
"Of course I haven't. It means some nonsense."
"Well, what was the word, then?"
"As if I were going to disgrace myself before a visitor. Most likely it means something shameful. Strike me dumb if I'll say it.
Well, you have forgotten, then.
Well, I haven't, then. Penates. Love your penates. That's what he invents. Perhaps there never were any penates. Oh, why should one love them? He's always talking nonsense.
That at Madame Bubnov's.
Phew, you and your Bubnov.
And Alexandra Semyonovna ran out of the room in great indignation.
It's time to go. Goodbye, Alexandra Semyonovna.
We went out.
Look here, Vanya. First, let's get into this cab. That's right. And secondly, I found out something after I had said goodbye to you yesterday, and not by guesswork, but for a certainty, I spent a whole hour in Vasilevsky Island. That fat man, an awful scoundrel, a nasty, filthy brute, up to all sorts of tricks and with vile tastes of all kinds. This Bubnov has long been notorious for some shifty doings in the same line. She was almost caught over a little girl of respectable family the other day. The muslin dress she dressed that orphan up in, as you described this morning, won't let me rest, because I've heard something of the sort already. I learnt something else this morning, quite by chance, but I think I can rely on it. How old is she?
From her face, I should say 13.
But small for her age. Well, this is how she'll do, then. When need be, she'll say she's 11, and another time that she's 15. And as the poor child has no one to protect her, she's...
Is it possible?
What do you suppose? Madame Bubnov wouldn't have adopted an orphan simply out of compassion. And if the fat man's hanging round, you may be sure it's that. He saw her yesterday. And that blockhead Sizobyohov's been promised a beauty today. A married woman, an officer's wife, a woman of rank. These profligate merchant sons are always keen on that. They're always on the lookout for rank. It's like that rule in the Latin grammar. Do you remember? The significance takes precedence of the ending. But I believe I'm still drunk from this morning. But Bubnov had better not dare meddle in such doings. She wants to dupe the police, too. But that's rot. And so I'll give her a scare, for she knows that for the sake of old scores and all the rest of it. Do you understand?
I was terribly shocked. All these revelations alarmed me. I kept being afraid we were too late and urged on the cabman.
Don't be uneasy. Measures have been taken,
said Maslobuev.
Mitroska's there. Zizobrilov will pay for it with money. But the fat scoundrel with his skin. That was settled this morning. Well, and Bubnov comes to my share. For don't let her dare.
We drew up at the eating house, but the man called Mitroshka was not there. Telling the cabman to wait for us at the eating house steps, we walked to Madame Bubnov's. Mitroshka was waiting for us at the gate. There was a bright light in the windows, and we heard Sizobryov's drunken, giggling laugh.
They're all here. Have been a quarter of an hour.
Mitroshka announced.
Now's the very time.
But how shall we get in? I asked.
As visitors,
replied Maslobuev.
She knows me, and she knows Mitroshka, too. It's true, it's all locked up, but not for us.
He tapped softly at the gate, and it was immediately opened. The porter opened it and exchanged a signal with Mitroshka. We went in quietly. We were not heard from the house. The porter led us up the steps and knocked. His name was called from within. He answered that a gentleman said he wanted to speak to her. The door was opened, and we all went in together. The porter vanished.
Hey, who's this?
Screamed Madame Bubnov, standing drunken and dishevelled in the tiny entry with the candle in her hand.
Who?
Answered Maslobuev quickly.
How can you ask, Anna Trifonovna? Don't you know your honoured guests? Who, if not me, Philip Filippich?
Ah, Philip Filippich, it's you. Very welcome. But how is it you? I don't know. Please walk in.
She was completely taken aback.
Well, here? But there's a partition here. No, you must give us a better reception. We'll have a drop of champagne. But aren't there any little mademoiselles?
The woman regained her confidence at once.
Why, for such honoured guests, I'd get them if I had to dig for them underground. I'd send for them from the Kingdom of China.
Two words, Anna Trifonovna, darling. It's Sizobryov here.
Yes.
He's just the man I want. How dare he go off on the spree without me, the rascal?
I expect he's not forgotten you. He seems expecting someone. It must be you.
Maslobuev pushed the door, and we found ourselves in a small room with two windows, with geraniums in them, with wickerwork chairs and a wretched-looking piano, all as one would expect. But even before we went in, while we were still talking in the passage, Mitroshka had disappeared. I learned afterwards that he had not come in, but had been waiting behind the door. He had someone to open it to him afterwards. The dishevelled and painted woman I had seen peeping over Madame Bubnov's shoulder that morning was a pal of his. Szobryuhov was sitting on a skimpy little sofa of imitation mahogany before a round table with a cloth on it. On the table were two bottles of tepid champagne and a bottle of horrible rum, and there were plates of sweets from the confectioner's, biscuits and nuts of three sorts. At the table facing Szobryuhov sat a repulsive-looking, pockmarked female of 40 wearing a black taffeta dress and a bronze brooch and bracelets. This was the officer's wife, unmistakably a sham. Szobryuhov was drunk and perfectly satisfied. His fat friend was not with him.
"That's how people behave,"
Maslobov bawled at the top of his voice.
"After inviting one to Dusos, too."
"Philip Filipich doing us the pleasure,"
muttered Szobryuhov, getting up to meet us with a blissful air.
"Are you drinking?"
"Excuse me?"
"Don't apologize, but invite your guests to join you. We've come to keep it up with you. Here, I've brought a friend to join us."
Maslobov pointed to me.
"Delighted, that is, you do me pleasure.
Oh, do you call this champagne? It's more like kvass."
"You insult me."
"So you don't dare show yourself at Dusos, and after inviting one."
"He's just been telling me he's been in Paris,"
put in the officer's wife.
"He must be fibbing."
"Fedosia Titishna, don't insult me. I have been there, I've travelled."
"A peasant like him in Paris."
"We have been, we could. Me and Karp Vasilich. We cut a dash there. Do you know Karp Vasilich?"
"What do I want with your Karp Vasilich?"
"Why, it's only just... it might be worth your while. Why, it was there, in Paris, at Madame Joubert's, we broke an English pier glass."
"What did you break?"
"A pier glass. There was a looking glass over the whole wall, and Karp Vasilich was that drunk that he began jabbering Russian to Madame Joubert. He stood by that pier glass and leaned his elbow against it. And Joubert screamed at him in her own way that the pier glass cost 700 francs, that is over 400 rubles, and that he'd break it. He grinned and looked at me, and I was sitting on a sofa opposite, and a beauty beside me, not a mug like this one here, but a stunner, that's the only word for it. He cries out, 'Stepan Terentich, hi, Stepan Terentich, we'll go halves, shall we?' And I said, 'Done,' and then he banged his fist on the looking-glass, crash! The glass was all in splinters. Joubert squealed and went for him straight in the face. 'What are you about, you ruffian?' In her own lingo, that is. 'Madame Joubert,' says he, 'here's the price of it, and don't disperse my character.' And on the spot he forked out 650 francs. They haggled over the other 50.
At that moment a terrible piercing shriek was heard two or three rooms away from the one in which we were. I shuddered, and I too cried out. I recognized that shriek. It was the voice of Elena. Immediately after that pitiful shriek we heard other outcries, oaths, a scuffle, and finally the loud, resonant, distinct sound of a slap in the face. It was probably Mitroshka inflicting retribution in his own fashion. Suddenly the door was violently flung open and Elena rushed into the room with a white face and dazed eyes, in a white muslin dress, crumpled and torn, and her hair, which had been carefully arranged, dishevelled as though by a struggle. I stood facing the door, and she rushed straight to me and flung her arms round me. Everyone jumped up. Everybody was alarmed. There were shouts and exclamations when she appeared. Then Mitroshka appeared in the doorway, dragging after him by the hair his fat enemy, who was in a hopelessly dishevelled condition. He dragged him up to the door and flung him into the room.
"Here he is! Take him!"
Mitroshka brought out with an air of complete satisfaction.
"I say,"
said Maslobov, coming quietly up to me and tapping me on the shoulder.
"Take our cab, take the child with you and drive home. There's nothing more for you to do here. We'll arrange the rest tomorrow."
I did not need telling twice. I seized Elena by the arm and took her out of that den. I don't know how things ended there. No one stopped us. Madame Bubnov was panic-stricken. Everything had passed so quickly that she did not know how to interfere. The cab was waiting for us, and in 20 minutes we were at my lodgings. Elena seemed half dead. I unfastened the hooks of her dress, sprinkled her with water, and laid her on the sofa. She began to be feverish and delirious. I looked at her white little face, at her colourless lips, at her black hair which had been done up carefully and pomaded, though it had come down on one side, at her whole get-up, at the pink bows which still remained here and there on her dress, and I had no doubt at all about the revolting facts. Poor little thing. She grew worse and worse. I did not leave her, and I made up my mind not to go to Natasha's that evening. From time to time Elena raised her long, arrow-like eyelashes to look at me, and gazed long and intently as though she recognized me. It was late, past midnight, when at last she fell asleep. I slept on the floor not far from her. Chapter 8. I got up very early. I had waked up almost every half hour through the night and gone up to look intently at my poor little visitor. She was in a fever and slightly delirious, but towards morning she fell into a sound sleep. A good sign, I thought, but when I waked in the morning I decided to run for the doctor while the poor little thing was still asleep. I knew a doctor, a very good-natured old bachelor, who with his German housekeeper had lived in Vladimirsky Street from time immemorial. I set off to him. He promised to be with me at 10 o'clock. It was 8 when I reached him. I felt much inclined to call in at Maslobuev's on the way, but I thought better of it. He was sure not to be awake yet after yesterday. Besides, Elena might wake up and be frightened at finding herself alone in my room. In her feverish state, she might well forget how and when she had come there. She waked up at the moment when I went into the room. I went up to her and cautiously asked her how she felt. She did not answer, but bent a long, long, intent look upon me with her expressive black eyes. I thought from the look in her eyes that she was fully conscious and understood what had happened. Her not answering me perhaps was just her invariable habit. Both on the previous day and on the day before that, when she had come to see me, she had not uttered a word in answer to some of my questions, but had only looked into my face with her slow, persistent stare, in which there was a strange pride as well as wonder and wild curiosity. Now I noticed a severity, even a sort of mistrustfulness in her eyes. I was putting my hand on her forehead to feel whether she was still feverish, but quietly, without a word, she put back my hand with her little one and turned away from me to the wall. I walked away that I might not worry her. I had a big copper kettle. I had long used it instead of a samovar for boiling water. I had wood. The porter had brought me up enough to last for 5 days. I lighted the stove, fetched some water, and put the teapot on. I laid the tea-things on the table. Elena turned towards me and watched it all with curiosity. I asked her whether she would not have something, but again she turned away from me and made no answer. Why is she angry with me? I wondered. Queer little girl. My old doctor came at 10 o'clock, as he had promised. He examined the patient with German thoroughness and greatly cheered me by saying that though she was feverish, there was no special danger. He added that she probably had another chronic disease, some irregularity in the action of the heart, but that point would want special watching, for now she's out of danger. More from habit than necessity, he prescribed her a mixture and some powders, and at once proceeded to ask me how she came to be with me. At the same time, he looked about my room wonderingly. The old man was an awful chatterbox. He was struck with Elena. She pulled her hand away when he tried to feel her pulse, and would not show him her tongue. To all his questions she did not answer one word. All the while she stared intently at the enormous Stanislav order that hung upon his neck.
"Most likely her head is aching badly,"
said the old man.
"But how she does stare!"
I did not think it necessary to tell him all about Elena, so I put him off, saying it was a long story.
"Let me know if there's any need,"
said he as he went away.
"But at present there's no danger."
I made up my mind to stay all day with Elena, and to leave her alone as rarely as possible till she was quite well. But knowing that Natasha and Anna Andreevna would be worried if they expected me in vain, I decided to let Natasha know by post that I could not be with her that day. I could not write to Anna Andreevna. She had asked me herself, once for all, not to send her letters, after I had once sent her news when Natasha was ill.
"My old man scowls when he sees a letter from you," she said. "He wants to know, poor dear, what's in the letter, and he can't ask, he can't bring himself to. and so he's upset for the whole day. And besides, my dear, you only tantalize me with letters. What's the use of a dozen lines? One wants to ask the details, and you're not there.
And so I wrote only to Natasha, and when I took the prescription to the chemist's, I posted the letter. Meanwhile, Elena fell asleep again. She moaned faintly and started in her sleep. The doctor had guessed right. She had a bad headache. From time to time, she cried out and woke up. She looked at me with positive vexation, as though my attention was particularly irksome. I must confess, this wounded me. At 11 o'clock, Maslobuev turned up. He was preoccupied and seemed absent-minded. He only came in for a minute and was in a great hurry to get away.
"Well, brother, I didn't expect that you lived in great style,"
he observed, looking round.
"But I didn't think I should find you in such a box. This is a box, not a lodging. But that's nothing, though what does matter is that all these outside worries take you off your work. I thought of that yesterday when we were driving to Bubnov's. By natural temperament, brother, and by social position, I'm one of those people who can do nothing sensible themselves, but can read sermons to other people. Now, listen, I'll look in, perhaps, tomorrow or next day, and you be sure to come and see me on Sunday morning. I hope by then the problem of this child will be completely settled. Then we'll talk things over seriously, for you need looking after in earnest. You can't go on living like this. I only dropped a hint yesterday, but now I'll put it before you logically. And tell me, in short, do you look on it as a dishonour to take money from me for a time?"
"Come, don't quarrel," I interrupted. "You'd better tell me how things ended there yesterday."
"Well, they ended most satisfactorily. My object was attained, you understand. I've no time now. I only looked in for a minute to tell you I'm busy and have no time for you, and to find out, by the way, whether you're going to place her somewhere, or whether you mean to keep her yourself. Because it wants thinking over and settling."
"That I don't know for certain yet, and I must own I was waiting to ask your advice. How could I keep her?"
"Why, as a servant."
"Please, don't speak so loud. Though she's ill, she's quite conscious, and I noticed she started when she saw you. No doubt she remembered yesterday." Then I told him about her behavior and all the peculiarities I had noticed in her. Maslobuev was interested in what I'd told him. I added that perhaps I could place her in a household, and told him briefly about my old friends. To my astonishment, he knew something of Natasha's story, and when I asked him how he had heard of it,
"Oh," he said, "I heard something about it long ago in connection with some business. I've told you already that I know Prince Valkovsky. That's a good idea of yours to send her to those old people. She'd only be in your way. And another thing, she wants some sort of a passport. Don't you worry about that. I'll undertake it. Goodbye. Come and see me often. Is she asleep now?"
"I think so," I answered. But as soon as he had gone, Elena called to me.
"Who's that?"
she asked. Her voice shook, but she looked at me with the same intent and haughty expression. I can find no other word for it. I told her Maslobuev's name, and said that it was by his help I got her away from Madame Bubnov's, and that Madame Bubnov was very much afraid of him. Her cheeks suddenly flushed fiery red, probably at the recollection of the past.
"And she will never come here?"
asked Elena with a searching look at me. I made haste to reassure her. She remained silent, and was taking my hand in her burning fingers, but she dropped it again at once, as though recollecting herself. It cannot be that she really feels such an aversion for me, I thought. It's her manner, or else the poor little thing has had so much trouble that she mistrusts everyone. At the hour fixed, I went out to fetch the medicine, and at the same time went into a restaurant where they knew me and gave me credit. I took a pot with me, and brought back some chicken broth for Elena. But she would not eat, and the soup remained for the time on the stove. I gave her her medicine and sat down to my work. I thought she was asleep, but chancing to look round at her, I saw that she had raised her head and was intently watching me write. I pretended not to notice her. At last she really did fall asleep, and to my great delight she slept quietly without delirium or moaning. I fell into a reverie. Natasha, not knowing what was the matter, might well be angry with me for not coming today, would be sure, indeed, I reflected, to be hurt at my neglect, just when perhaps she needed me most. She might at this moment have special worries, perhaps some service to ask of me, and I was staying away as though expressly. As for Anna Andreevna, I was completely at a loss as to how I should excuse myself to her next day. I thought it over, and suddenly made up my mind to run round to both of them. I should only be absent about 2 hours. Elena was asleep, and would not hear me go out. I jumped up, took my coat and cap, but just as I was going out, Elena called me. I was surprised. Could she have been pretending to be asleep? I may remark in parentheses that, though Elena made a show of not wanting to speak to me, these rather frequent appeals, this desire to apply to me in every difficulty, showed a contrary feeling, and I confess it really pleased me.
"Where do you mean to send me?"
she asked when I went up to her. She generally asked her questions all of a sudden when I did not expect them. This time, I did not take in her meaning at first.
"You were telling your friend just now that you meant to place me in some household. I don't want to go."
I bent down to her. She was hot all over. Another attack of fever had come on. I began trying to soothe and pacify her, assuring her that if she cared to remain with me, I would not send her away anywhere. Saying this, I took off my coat and cap. I could not bring myself to leave her alone in such a condition.
"No, go,"
she said, realizing at once that I was meaning to stay.
"I'm sleepy. I shall go to sleep directly."
"But how will you get on alone?" I said, uncertainly. "Though I'd be sure to be back in 2 hours' time."
"Well, go then. Suppose I'm ill for a whole year. You can't stay at home all the time."
And she tried to smile and looked strangely at me as though struggling with some kindly feeling stirring in her heart. Poor little thing. Her gentle, tender heart showed itself in glimpses in spite of her aloofness and evident mistrust. First, I ran round to Anna Andreevna. She was waiting for me with feverish impatience, and she greeted me with reproaches. She was in terrible anxiety. Nikolai Sergeyitch had gone out immediately after dinner, and she did not know where. I had a presentiment that she had not been able to resist telling him everything in hints, of course, as she always did. She practically admitted it herself, telling me that she could not resist sharing her joyful tidings with him, but that Nikolai Sergeyitch had become, to use her expression, blacker than night, that he had said nothing.
"He wouldn't speak, wouldn't even answer my questions, and suddenly, after dinner, had got ready and gone out."
When she told me this, Anna Andreevna was almost trembling with dismay, and besought me to stay with her until Nikolai Sergeyitch came back. I excused myself and told her almost flatly that perhaps I should not come next day either, and that I had really hurried to her now to tell her so. This time we almost quarrelled. She shed tears, reproached me harshly and bitterly, and only when I was just going out at the door she suddenly threw herself on my neck, held me tight in both arms, and told me not to be angry with a lonely creature like her, and not to resent her words. Contrary to my expectations, I found Natasha again alone. And strange to say, it seemed to me that she was by no means so pleased to see me as she had been the day before and on other occasions, as though I were in the way or somehow annoying her. When I asked whether Alyosha had been there that day, she answered,
"Of course he has, but he didn't stay long. He promised to look in this evening."
She went on, hesitating. "And yesterday evening, was he here?"
"No. He was detained,"
she added quickly.
"Well, Vanya, how are things going with you?"
I saw that she wanted to stave off our conversation and begin a fresh subject. I looked at her more intently. She was evidently upset, but noticing that I was glancing at her and watching her closely, she looked at me rapidly and, as it were, wrathfully, and with such intensity that her eyes seemed to blaze at me. "She is miserable again," I thought, "but she doesn't want to speak to me about it." In answer to her question about my work, I told her the whole story of Elena in full detail. She was extremely interested and even impressed by my story.
"Good heavens, and you could leave her alone and ill,"
she cried. I told her that I had meant not to come at all that day, but that I was afraid she would be angry with me and that she might be in need of me.
"Need?"
she said to herself, as though pondering.
"Perhaps I do need you, Vanya, but that had better be another time. Have you been to my people?"
I told her.
"Yes, God only knows how my father will take the news. Though what is there to take after all?"
"What is there to take?" I repeated. "A transformation like this?"
"I don't know about that. Where can he have gone again? That time before, you thought he was coming to me. Do you know, Vanya, come to me tomorrow if you can. I shall tell you something, perhaps. Only I'm ashamed to trouble you. But now you'd better be going home to your visitor. I expect it's 2 hours since you came out.
Yes, it is. Goodbye, Natasha. Well, and how was Alyosha with you today?
Oh, Alyosha. All right. I wonder at your curiosity.
Goodbye for now, my friend.
Goodbye.
She gave me her hand carelessly and turned away from my last farewell look. I went out, somewhat surprised. She has plenty to think about, though, I thought. It's no jesting matter. Tomorrow she'll be the first to tell me all about it. I went home sorrowful and was dreadfully shocked as soon as I opened the door. By now it was dark. I could make out Elena sitting on the sofa, her head sunk on her breast as though plunged in deep thought. She didn't even glance at me. She seemed lost to everything. I went up to her. She was muttering something to herself. Isn't she delirious? I thought. Elena, my dear, what's the matter? I asked, sitting beside her and putting my arm round her.
I want to go away. I'd better go to her,
she said, not raising her head to look at me. Where? To whom? I asked in surprise.
To her. To Bubnov. She's always saying I owe her a lot of money, that she buried Mother at her expense. I don't want her to say nasty things about Mother. I want to work there and pay her back. Then I'll go away of myself. But now I'm going back to her.
Be quiet, Elena. You can't go back to her, I said. She'll torment you. She'll ruin you.
Let her ruin me. Let her torment me.
Elena caught up the words feverishly.
I'm not the first. Others better than I are tormented. A beggar woman in the